This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Seamus Heaney was announced as the winner of the 2006 T.S. Eliot Prize for his latest collection of poetry, District and Circle. Seamus Heaney, welcome to The 11th Hour. Congrats on your recent award. What's it like to win the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry?
Well, in this case, I was delighted because I have considerable respect for the judges outside of their judging capacity. I mean, there's two poets whom I know well, third one not so well, but I know her work a bit. There's a Welsh poet who writes in Welsh and in English, Gwyneth Lewis. I don't really know her personally very well, but I admire her as a presence. And then there's Sean O'Brien, who's an English poet and critic, and he's fairly strict and can be fairly dry. I like the idea that the judges, first of all, they weren't into sucking up to anybody. And I also like the idea that it was a pretty strong field of other poets on the list, you know. So, but, you know, I think your own sense of your work and your own trust in it is the first thing you have to go by. And if there's that, in a sense, you're safe enough, you know. I felt safe with this book, and it's gratifying that it was saluted like that. So the other thing is that the T.S. Eliot Award, I mean, Eliot's name has a certain resonance still, you know, so there's a pleasure in that too.
There's a huge resonance, Eliot's name. Yep. You were unable to attend the prize giving because you've been ill. How are you getting on? Are you recuperating?
I'm in good order, but I am resolutely not going on out. I cancelled everything. I had a stroke at the end of August. I was in hospital for 6 weeks and advised to take it canny and take it calm. So I used that time to cancel everything up until next August, really. I mean, I've been very busy all my life, and I've been doing a lot of things and stuff that you feel obliged to do for friends, stuff that you feel you should be doing for festivals, maybe, and so on. So I just took the opportunity to say sorry, and I'm not doing any readings, not doing any travel. I'm lying low for a few months. Fortunately enough, you can do a radio interview without travelling too far.
We really appreciate that. We hope you listen to your doctor now and not writing poetry.
No. Well, I'm actually getting some work done. That's the other thing. Yeah, I mean, writing your own poetry is its own reward, so to speak. I was sorry not to go to the T.S. Eliot readings. There were readings on Sunday night in London, and there was a kind of reception thing there last night. But I had to act with party of esteem or party of disesteem, so I couldn't go one place and not go another. So, but it was mitigated a good bit when I heard that they had awarded the thing in absentia. So that was fine. My daughter was there, so she was able to go up and carry away the loot, which is something.
Go back to your book of District and Circle, which was issued last year to tremendous sales and critical acclaim. The poem Anything Can Happen, which we heard at the top of the programme, became one of the world's most popular poems post 9/11. Why was this? Is poetry the modern prayer in times of doubt? Do we look for truth in poetry?
Well, the interesting thing about that poem is that it was written, first of all, it's a translation, it's a version of a poem by the Roman poet Horace. It was written over 2,000 years ago. It was about being, in its original form, it was about being shocked, about hearing thunder, but thunder striking out of a clear sky, and the man is rocked back to his foundations. He's brought into a kind of state of awe and fear. The poem says anything. I mean, I translated it as anything can happen. It's something like Deus imo valet, like the God certainly has power. But it's a poem about shock, shock and awe, as they say.
Shock and awe, yeah.
And about being rocked back to fundamentals. And also, the actual Latin has, that God has power, he can make the summa, the highest things can be brought down. And the ignota, the people who are ignored, omens that can be brought forward. So I have to say, immediately, I had talked about this poem at Harvard University when I was there in the year 2000. I was teaching and I was picking various poems that I thought would be interesting to talk about to students. And I picked this one, saying that one of the things that poetry can do is to register the deepest psychic shocks. This was before the 9/11 business. But when the towers were struck down, I suddenly remembered this this particular poem. So it's a version of the Horus thing. I think that's the thing about lyric poetry. It deals with inner circumstances of the consciousness and the psyche, and can transmit those right through. You know, beam it up or beam it down from Homer right down to now, and from Horace right down to now. So I was lucky that the poem fitted it. I have to confess to adding an extra stanza to it.
Poetic license, I believe they call it.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
I also enjoy, I must say, personally, being a country boy, I enjoy your sort of the industrial archaeology of your memory, if I may call it that. The turnip schnitter, the sugon. Do people in Oxford and Cambridge understand what a turnip schnitter is?
Well, no, they don't necessarily need to know what a turnip schnitter is. They need to get the charge out of the words. And I mean, it has an extra charge for people who remember those things, the pulpers. And in the American edition, I've got a terrific photograph of a pulper and a guy standing beside it. It's made by, I've forgotten the name of the firm in Wexford, you know, it's kind of...
Pierce,
that's right, Pierce and Company, that's right. But I think there's an extra intimacy comes from people who know those things, what they are. On the other hand, the strangeness of them has got its virtue too. I mean, I didn't know much about New England woods when I read Frost, first of all. After I went to Massachusetts and saw the birch trees and all that, I began to see the thing in a different way. Frost has a wonderful poem called Birches. He talks about an ice storm in it. And all that had a glamour in it for me before I saw New England trees bent with ice, birches bowed down with ice like glass beards hanging on them, you know. So I think that if a poem is transmitting, it's transmitting something beyond just the documentary or reality of the thing. It's giving you images and melody of some sort. So it should have some sort of a psychic weight and appeal as well as documentary reality for you.
You know, the archaeology of memory is important too, I think.
I agree, yeah. And it's something that I've been digging at for a good while. So,
and also, I love the story about the poet's instruction to the blacksmith about the spade. But we'll talk about it another day after we've done a bit more digging on that one.
That's Owen Ruha.
That's Owen Ruha.
The spade was a necessary tool for Owen Ruha, the spalpeen, a labouring man himself. But it is, it's a terrific poem. Great lift to it.
Yeah. I love the way that at the end of the poem it says that the sound of the spade was really important. It reminded me of Mórtionoy Dionne's Fara Glanna Creed, the Glimshon Shroidje, or Spoidje, Binion Wims, Nyarachir.
The Western Spring. Good man.
All right, Seamus.
Bye now.
That was Seamus Heaney, who was announced as winner of the T.S. Eliot Prize for his latest collection of poetry, District and Circle. And that was Hugh Tinney performing Chopin's Waltz in C sharp minor there. Hugh, why did you choose that piece?
First of all, I love it. I've been playing that piece for years and years and years. It's one of those pieces that it's part of me. I think it's probably deep in the brain somewhere. But also, I think it's appropriate in the sense that Chopin inspired so many of the Russian school of composers, great piano composers. Rachmaninoff, obviously, is whom we're talking about, but also others like Scriabin, and a lot of that. Chopin was one of the big influences. He was the first, if you like, outstanding Slavic composer who bared the soul, if you like, of the Slav, while at the same time revolutionising, if you like, a school of piano playing which had been a little bit drawing room, if you like. It was sort of regarded pretty, yeah, pretty, pretty music. And Chopin started off like that and wrote a few pieces in that style. But that waltz there gives you an example of the depth, the great musical depth, which he could reach with a very simple form.
He experimented with studies. Was that sort of like to check out the technical variation of the piano or to create new techniques? And what was his objective in the studies?
I think all of the above. I think we still look back to the Chopin studies as the key. You know, it's funny because I teach also, and I get young pianists coming in to me, you know, and they're always saying, oh, I've done the Hannon etudes, Hannon studies and so on. And I never did Hannon in my life. But I say to them, but what about the Chopin studies? Because, you know, that's the core of the romantic technique. And later composers like Liszt, obviously, and then Rachmaninoff and Scriabin all wrote a lot of studies, but Chopin was the first and the most significant, if you like, to write the concert study, the study that was actually, again, a musically valuable work. There are many of the studies that people love, like the How Deep Is the Night one and so on. You know, the people know these pieces, and yet they were also devised to develop technique and to develop the techniques of the instrument, if you like.
And was the instrument fully developed? Was the piano, as we know, developed by the time Chopin was playing it?
No, it wasn't. And indeed, an acquaintance of Chopin, if not exactly a friend, Liszt, the first great touring virtuoso, if you like, father of the modern concert pianist, he used to have a terrible time because he used to play around these pianos, playing on uprights. He came to Ireland, he played, I think, on an upright piano here, and he would break the strings off them. The strings just weren't up to that level of playing, you know. So it was a case of an artist in search of an instrument, you know. So it had a long way to go, but I think that the second half of the 19th century saw a lot of developments, and by the time you come to Rachmaninoff at the beginning of the 20th century, when he's already in his playing heydays, he's aged about 30, you have essentially the modern instrument, the same as we have today 100 years later.
And where does Rachmaninoff connect with Chopin?
First of all, I think on both the things I mentioned, the Slavic spirit, if you like, which was, Chopin had such a strong personality. I mean, it was such a distinctive personality. This he took all these short forms like the waltzes, the mazurkas, the Polish polonaises, yes, but mazurkas particularly, the shorter dance, Polish dance. I think he had huge influence on, as I said, that whole school of composers. They saw him as an inspiration to writing their nationalist school, if you like, the Russian nationalist school of music. That started with that. But also the sheer technical, what we've just been talking about, the technical range that he opened up and that composers then took on even further. So certainly Liszt took it on even further in certain directions. But they were so inspired. And you find that with, say, Rachmaninoff and Scriabin, their early works in particular, works that they may have written when they were 15, 16, 17, 18, are really modelled on Chopin. Rachmaninoff's most famous piece, the piece that he became absolutely disgusted with, so disgusted he called it It. It was the early prelude in C-sharp minor, which he wrote in 1890. And in the same key, actually, as the both pieces I'm playing today, C-sharp minor. And it just enormously caught on. But I think all of those pieces were very Chopin-influenced.
Rachmaninoff had plenty of trouble in producing his music. He wasn't happy after he produced his first symphony, and then he produced a second concerto after psychiatric help.
Psychiatric help. Psychiatrist called Nikolai Dahl, who was a hypnotist, amongst other things. And Rachmaninoff, I think, had been in the doldrums for 2 or 3 years after that. Apparently the first performance of his first symphony was a disaster. Glazunov was another composer, but it was the conductor, and they say that he was drunk at the time of the performance. So it was absolutely slated by reviewers. And poor old Rachmaninoff, who was, I think, of a dark disposition anyway, just completely lost it at that stage, and managed to, one of the things that really stimulated him again was regular visits to this psychiatrist, who sort of put him on the narrow, and I think used to essentially, what would you call it, affirmation. It was hypnotising him and then just telling him, you can compose, you will compose a great work, it will be, you know, that kind of thing. And it's amazing how the subconscious just listens to these things, and Rachmaninoff started to believe again in himself, and as we know, produced the second piano concerto, which is probably to this day his most popular work of all works.
Most people would be familiar with it from its incursion into Hollywood lore.
Brief Encounter, yes, exactly. But funnily, I've never seen that film, you know, so perhaps to the younger generation of today, they mightn't know that so much. It's like I mentioned, for example, the How Deep Is the Night? You know, there's the... that Chopin study, but a lot of people of the younger generation wouldn't even know that title, because it's funny, the titles die where the pieces can live on.
Yeah. What are the challenges in playing Rachmaninoff? I know from the film Shine that it can be very challenging technically to play Rachmaninoff.
Yes, indeed. In fact, that film centred around the third piano concerto, which is more monstrous than the second. It's kind of the second squared, if you know what I mean, and it has more notes reputedly than any other concerto of the period. And Rachmaninoff himself, one has to be aware, was an absolutely exceptional pianist. There are those who still feel he was possibly the greatest pianist of the 20th century from the old recordings that we have of him. He was certainly an absolutely exceptional pianist, and his writing in all of these piano concertos, including the Rhapsody in a Scene of Paganini, which is another very popular one, it shows and it relates to his mastery of the instrument. Wonderful writing, for example, for the left hand, which is constantly running up and down the piano and doing little lines of its own. He didn't go in for so much of the kind of techniques that Liszt had used, which would be runs of octaves, massive runs of octaves by themselves, you know, or tremolandos. That type of thing. Or he didn't go in an awful lot for that kind of writing either, which Liszt wrote a huge amount of. But Rachmaninoff, it's more... Or the more, even more famous... That's the style.
And what's the joy in playing Rachmaninoff?
Fantastic joy. The real joy, when you get a work like, say, the Second Piano Concerto, which is so beautifully written, so idiomatically written for the instrument by a master pianist who was a great composer who was writing one of his best works, the whole thing just slots together. And essentially, you're kind of sailing, you know, you're sailing, because it is such a wonderful experience that you are actually recreating this. You're not passive. You're recreating, you're playing it, you're moulding it at every second. If you want to delay a fraction of a second for a note, you're in control and you can do that. And the emotional, the emotional reward is huge.
Could you introduce the piece you're going to play for us now?
Well, this is a very early study by Scriabin, who was a classmate, in fact, at that age, in 15-16, was classmate of Rachmaninoff, born just the year before, 1872. When he was about 15 or 16, he wrote this piece, which, as I was intimating earlier, very much in the style of Chopin, and yet very similar to what Rachmaninoff might have written at that time, very Slavic and intense music.
Hugh Tinney there performing Scriabin's prelude in C sharp minor. And Hugh performs Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto tomorrow, Friday, at the National Concert Hall. Also at the Concert Hall, the RTE National Symphony Orchestra will premiere new music from composer Kevin O'Connell, his four orchestral pieces. A new play by U3 Theatre Company opened the Half Moon Theatre in Cork. Father Matthew tells the story of Father Theobald Matthew, the Irish temperance reformer who lived from 1790 to 1856. The play is written by Sean McCarthy and directed by John Breen. We sent Dr. Avery Walsh of UCC and writer Thomas McCarthy along to see the show. Before we hear what they say, let's hear a report on the production by Brian O'Connell. Brian began by talking to the author of Father Matthew, Sean McCarthy.
Here's up the mall, says the boys of Fair Hill. The smell of Patrick's pitch is a wicket. How does Father Matthew's ticket? Here's up the mall, says...
The thing about Father Matthew was that he was of the liberal wing of the church. He was very close to, I suppose, what we would be begun to call liberation theology, which grew up in South America in the 60s and the 70s. He would have been very much of that wing of the church. In fact, he clashed quite openly at times with the establishment, the church establishment. The two big figures in the church at that time, which were Archbishop MacHail of Galway and Dr. Cullen, later Cardinal Cullen, who became Ireland's first cardinal. So in that... he was known as the vagabond friar. So in that case, he was very much a hero of the people rather than a heroic figure within the church. Dr. Cullen opposed his nomination as Bishop of Cork because of his liberal views towards the Protestant faith and because of his desire to have the laity involved in church life. So in that sense, he wasn't part of the what we call the official church. But I think Father Matthew's status obviously now needs to change. We now appear to have an epidemic of drinking in this country. We read about it, you know the statistics yourself. There was an epidemic of alcoholism in his time as well. In his time, the epidemic was caused by poverty, extreme poverty. In our time, it's caused by affluence. And for 5 or 6 years in the middle of the 19th century, Ireland was sober. It's an extraordinary achievement. You know, we know that not because of the numbers who were members of his Total Abstinence Association, but from figures from the Exchequer, consumption of alcohol went down by 40% and the crime rate went down dramatically in relation to that. You know, he was this extraordinary charismatic character who spoke to audiences of thousands of people. His society had certainly at least 3 million members at one point. He was probably the best known Irishman of his generation outside of Daniel O'Connell. What happened at the end of that, of course, was the famine and a whole disruption of society. But it was an extraordinary time.
And what was he like in his personal life, Sean? What type of a man? Okay, you've said charismatic, but on a day-to-day level or amongst friends, what type of a man was Father Matthew?
He had quite a flamboyant personality. He was of an almost ascendancy background, yet he was able to bridge the divide in Cork between the very rich and the very poor. The very rich related to him because he was one of the Matthews of Thomastown, who were quite a well-known landed gentry family, and the poor because he helped them. And he had this concept of building what he called a bridge of gold between those who have and those who have not, those who want for everything and those who have everything. And he formed a society called the Josephians, which I suppose was a precursor of what we call the Vincent de Paul or the Sick Poor Societies that we have today. And he was an incredibly generous man, often and nearly always with other people's money, and which landed him in very serious trouble. In fact, he was put in prison for debt at one point in Dublin. And right to the end of his days, he was plagued with debts and banks and creditors chasing him literally to the grave.
And the production, Sean, quite a big undertaking, given the fact that people are, I guess, familiar with the story. What new do you bring to the table?
When I came back to visit Cork, this would be 20 years, having been away for more than 20 years. I met with Gerry Barnes and he talked about me writing a play specifically for Cork. Gerry at the time ran a company called the Cork Theatre Company. I thought it would be interesting to find out more about Father Matthew and possibly write a play about him. And it was at that stage that my research into Father Matthew began. That project never got off the ground. Other things intervened. And I put the research to one side, though I continued to dabble in it from time to time. It's proved that it was a very good thing that it didn't happen in the 1980s, because in 92 it was, I went to Boston. And I found out information on Father Matthew in the public library in Boston, which had been hitherto unknown to me. And this information has proved vital in the structuring of this particular play. Unfortunately, it's not good news about Father Matthew. He was a man who took a drink himself and took a good drink, as they say. And he didn't actually start the temperance movement until his 47th year. Now, whether he was a drunkard or whether he was an alcoholic in embryo, so to speak, is a matter of question, you know. But certainly that's the area of the play we go into most deeply.
Jimmy Crowley, balladeer, songwriter and quintessential Cork man. Jimmy, I guess down through the years, Jimmy, you would have sang many a song with Father Matthew in it.
My own connection with Father Matthew was in a ballad I wrote myself about Richie Ryan, who was long before your time, but he was a minister for finance, who shall go down in history as the man who made the pint of stout more expensive than a drop of whiskey. He clapped an unmerciful shilling on it in 76, down here in the coalition government of 76, I think, or 77. And I wrote a song, and we sold this ballad sheet in the street, like in the traditional way, and we had a cartoon of Father Matthew, but with Richie Ryan's head on Father Matthew's torso. And one verse went, if you'll go down to Patrick Street, you're sure to meet with Father Matcha. He's a temperate man of high degree. Sometimes for short he's called the stature. He tried to keep us off the booze. Upon it looked with reprobation. Now if he had Richie by his side, he'd have success throughout the nation. All him punches, all him tears, and Lani action, all him teddy.
I'm joined now in a Cork studio by Dr. Eva Welch of UCC and writer Thomas McCarthy. Went along to the opening night of the Half Moon Theatre on behalf of the 11th Hour this evening. Eva and Thomas, you're both very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Eva, the playwright Sean McCarthy is internationally renowned for his individual and experimental approach to theatre. How did he treat the subject of Father Matthew?
Quite experimentally. He has three characters. Father Matthew himself, played by Malcolm Adams. John, who's his sort of assistant, again, really well played by Liam Heffernan. And then the demon, played by Carl Kennedy. Initially, Father Matthew's sort of demon drink, and then a sort of companion, an inner voice to him. So it's just the three men, and the play uses just a very straightforward set and tells the story of Father Matthew's life through using this sort of almost very spare world.
Tom, we heard in the report that some vital new evidence was uncovered during Sean McCarthy's research. Are there shocking revelations in the play?
Shocking if you think that he was a sober person. You could say the play is one long day in his life that lasted from 1832 until 1856, from the cholera epidemic until his death. And so the play is brilliantly written to... It sort of by suggestion, by personalising many of the tensions of the 19th century, Sean McCarthy has created a very anxious character, a broken character, if you like. And while I think Malcolm Adams as Father Matthew is brilliant, it takes a little while for us as an audience to warm to what Malcolm Adams is trying to do as a sort of aristocratic Father Matthew, really. But when it begins to get going, I think within about 15 minutes of the play, it's absolutely riveting. I think it's really a marvellous play, really well acted, and even the choreography and the set design by Marcus Costello is spare and brilliant. The choreography is superb, I think. Particularly the use of... In fact, there's almost a fourth character in the play, and that's the letters. There are bundles of letters. Letters being opened. Letters being passed downstairs to a desk. Letters being passed across from characters.
And what, the letters what information become, these letters given us?
Well, the letters become the kind of tensions of the 19th century. Brilliantly done, you know.
So the letter tell us of the cholera epidemic in Waterford?
They do,
or?
And they tell us about those crucial interventions where the cruelty of the world is visited upon poor Father Matthew as he tries to kind of save the world. And in many ways, the entire play is really about the use of the world in Matthew trying to save himself.
Did Father Matthew, how did he discover his ability to stand on top of a church gate and have 20,000 people take the pledge? Was there a revelation? Was there a moment where Father Matthew says, I am the charismatic God here? Or did that, how did that come work at all, ever?
I suppose what they did really was, that, as Tom was saying, it sort of got a bit of time to get going. And initially when we saw the Father Matthew, I suppose a lot of us would have known him as the temperance priest. And then when the actor starts sort of coming back from his very difficult night on cholera, working in the cholera house, obviously a man of great devotion and great practical Christianity, he starts swigging out of the brandy bottle. And, was, you know, the audience were kind of tittering the idea of this. But what really took off then was we got the fright of our lives. I won't explain why, but the brilliant introduction of the demon. And it's initially the demon drink. So the first half really takes on the idea of the struggle with alcohol. And from us sort of laughing at the traditional idea of Father Matthew being turned around a little bit, we see a very human struggle with this addiction. And, you know, this the demon is this sort of voice of his addiction. And from that, I think we then see the man taking the stage, becoming charismatic, becoming this great leader, and the great success that happened throughout, but at quite a cost.
Yeah, well, he made a catastrophic historical mistake in America. His use of the Old Testament and the
well, this would be in, this would be in his temperance days after he left Ireland in the 1850s, would it?
Yeah, I mean he really couldn't handle the whole question of slavery and the question of abolition in America. The Irish American politics and Southern politics, the Georgia politics and Boston politics. He was trying to negotiate between the needs of two different kinds of politics in America. And that's really, I think, a crucial moment in the play, the way it's handled, the way it's described within the action of the play, I think is absolutely brilliant. He was actually crushed, really, by the ambiguity, in a way, of his own position, you know.
He went to America to persuade Irish American and recently emigrated Irish people to take the pledge. Was that the case?
Exactly. In a way, he was escaping from his own first great failure, which was his failure to become the Bishop of Cork. And so, in a way, he looked on America as a new place where, in many ways, he might restore his reputation in the early 1850s. But it really was much more complex than he could have.
But Eber, when you put it like that, Tom, Eber, was Father Matthew all the time trying to sort of ingratiate himself with the church? Was he trying to make a name for himself so he would get power, so he would get the Bishopric of Cork?
No, he's presented in the play as a very honourable man and a man who has a charismatic vision and gift. He's also presented as a very impractical man. There's a very good balance between the two actors. Malcolm Adams presents him as a very courtly, rather refined. He keeps calling his friend John my dear, which I thought was very interesting. It's almost like a class, well, obviously it's a class difference, whereas Liam Heffernan playing John, very funny, but also a real solid mid-Victorian sort of man, a very practical sort of man. Father Matthew is very impractical. Money is a real problem. And to some degree, going to America is an attempt to solve all his really involved financial problems. So he's never seen as a venial man, which I think the play sees him. It sees him as very heroic, but it doesn't present him in very pious terms. I think it presents him in very human terms.
And was there other skeletons in his closet other than that he was formerly a heavy drinker and that he had no way of managing money?
Well, laudanum, I suppose.
Laudanum was the real problem towards the end of his life. The last years of his life were quite pathetic, really. It was almost like a decline of greatness, you know, in a man who had done great things. But it's very well done in the play, I think. Without a doubt, it's Sean McCarthy's best script. The direction is superb, I think. The whole ensemble works very, very well. I mean, the choreography and the acting. I think it's really one of the most brilliant uses of a historic subject I've ever seen in theatre, really.
And it could be very, because it's dealing with a lot of history, and it's dealing with the biography, the danger is that it turns into a kind of a history lesson or a kind of biopic, and it never did that, I thought.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your review of that show, and obviously by your praise, this is a very good show and really, people should go along to see it.
Definitely.
Father Matthew's running at the Half Moon Theatre in Cork on the 26th of January. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTÉ Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.